Hello there. Today is Tuesday, August 1st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump talks tough on how the U.S. will deal with North Korea.
It will be handled. We handle everything.
Support for the people and condemnation over Venezuela's president's power grab.
Maduro is not just a bad leader. He is now a dictator. The United States stands with the people of Venezuela in the face of this oppression.
Another shakeup in staff at the White House. Also ahead, a review on a new spy thriller out in movie theaters. It's all on today's International Edition. The United States has imposed sanctions on Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro over what it calls his illegitimate election of an assembly to rewrite the Constitution. All of Maduro's assets in the United States are frozen, and Americans are forbidden from doing any business with him. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin announced the sanctions Monday in Washington, calling Maduro a dictator who ignores the will of the Venezuelan people.
As President Trump said earlier this month, the strong and courageous actions by the Venezuelan people to stand for democracy, freedom, and the rule of law have been continually ignored by Nicolas Maduro, who dreams of becoming a dictator.
National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster said Maduro joins an exclusive club of dictators, including the leaders of Syria and North Korea, in terms of brutal repression of its people.
The United States stands with the people of Venezuela in the face of this oppression. We will work with our partners to hold accountable all those responsible for the escalating violence and ongoing human rights violations.
VOA's Victor Beatty talked about it with Rice University professor Mark Jones.
This constituent assembly in the election on Sunday represented the final nail in the coffin of Venezuela's democratic system. I think there is now no doubt whatsoever, even among Maduro's sympathizers outside of Venezuela, that he is a dictator, and that Venezuela is now, without question, a dictatorship. I think the only question that remains is to what extent we'll continue to see violence and chaos, or if there is an ability, particularly by the Latin American countries, to broker some type of negotiations that would allow for Maduro to leave power in a peaceful way, and for the opposition, as well as more pragmatic factions within the Chavista movement, to come to some type of agreement to allow Venezuela to get out of the really difficult and tragic situation in which it finds itself and move forward to some type of rapprochement and hopefully a return to democracy.
What do you think this new assembly is going to do? How quickly will it gather, and what will it do? How quickly will it do it?
Well, I would assume that it all depends on the show, because I suspect that its document has already been crafted and created, and it's merely a rubber stamp on the desire by Maduro and many in the Chavista movement, such as Diosdado Cabello, to essentially eliminate any last vestiges of democracy in the country. I think the only real question is the extent to which international pressure can apply some brakes to Maduro's effort. But I think at this point, he as well as his supporters have decided to double down. And I think as long as they retain the support of countries like China and Russia, who have no real incentive to support the democratic movement or to defect from Maduro, but they should be able to maintain control, although it will be within a context of increasing violence, chaos, and economic decline.
If everyone sees through this assembly as a sham, why bother going through that rigmarole?
You still have to have the performance. That is, it's political theater. When you have theater, you actually do have to have actors up on the stage performing roles. And he at least needs to go through the window dressing that this is somehow a democratic process. We saw the same often during the Soviet Union and other dictatorships, that they would hold elections and pretend that they were doing something that involved participation by the citizenry, but in reality, all it was doing was rubber stamping decisions that had been made behind closed doors by the governing elites.
Mark, opposition lawmakers met Monday to discuss strategies. What might those strategies be?
At this point, I think the opposition is divided into two main groups. One who is desperately trying to look for some type of way to come to a peaceful accord or a consensual agreement with moderate factions within the Chavista movement, as well as military officers. And another group that believes that those options simply don't exist, and the only real option that will cause a change in power is taking to the streets and often violent resistance.
That's Rice University professor Mark Jones. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Al-Shabaab militant is killed in a U.S. airstrike. Kenya police investigate the murder of an election official. The U.S. for the first time will sell coal to Ukraine. And President Trump awards the Medal of Honor to a Vietnam veteran. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app.
This is International Edition.
We turn now to what's trending on social media. We're joined by Andrew Palchevsky. Andrew, lots of crazy stuff going on, huh?
A lot to talk about. Perhaps the shortest tenure ever for a White House communications director, Anthony Scaramucci, removed from that position with the new swearing in of the new chief of staff, General John Kelly. So, of course, social media reacting to this news really breaking on social media, as we often see with these kinds of personnel movements within the White House. And shortly after the news spread around, we started to see the jokes spreading around as well. So we saw a lot of jokes about the very short, very brief tenure of Anthony Scaramucci as White House communications director. Many people putting RIP Scaramucci's career, July 2017 to July 2017. Lots of jokes at the length of time. Yeah. Lots of things that you can do in 10 days,
long
including
tenure.
Get hired and fired by the White House. A lot of people talking about that.
10 days.
And perhaps my favorite, because of the creativity, and it's a reference stretching back a few years. Someone photoshopped the movie poster for the 2003 romantic comedy How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. Starring Matthew McConaughey and Kate Hudson. Instead of Matthew McConaughey, they put Anthony Scaramucci's face. How to Lose a Job in 10 Days. But among all these jokes, there is some question about this move, what went into it. And there's a lot of speculation and talk about the new chief of staff, John Kelly. Could he be trying to right the ship by removing people like Anthony Scaramucci? Some saying that this firing or this removal, resignation, whatever you're going to call it, is actually a good sign that the White House is getting back under control and they're trying to stop some of the chaos.
Some discipline, right.
Some discipline from a former military general.
For sure.
Yes.
Anything else big that we should know about?
Yeah, a big lawsuit that could have big implications for President Trump. Actually, two lawsuits. We've talked about on the show in the past how President Trump is being sued for blocking people on Twitter, and that lawsuit alleges that by blocking people, he is diminishing their First Amendment right to free speech. Well, there was a case just this past week in Virginia, not too far outside of D.C., where a local official was actually in court because she blocked someone who she didn't like on her Facebook page. And the judge in that case said that she was not allowed to do that, said the politician who blocked her constituent was violating his First Amendment right. So that case is going to be an interesting one because it has potential implications for social media and maybe implications for this case with President Trump. Now, the ruling in that case, the type of lawsuit it was, doesn't mean that it can set legal precedent. However, it could set some public opinion as to whether or not social media can be blocked by public figures. And then we have another case just today in the state of Kentucky where the governor there has been sued because he blocked people on his Facebook and Twitter account. That might be one that has more legal precedent than this local one right in Virginia because the governor of Kentucky is a very much a public figure and this is a federal lawsuit. It could have big implications for President Trump. But this is something that we're seeing a lot more of. Public figures are being held to a different standard or higher standard on social media, as they often are held to a higher standard in life generally. And so I think we're going to see some laws coming down the pike about how social media is used by public figures, what they're allowed to do, what they're not allowed to do, and how they can use it and can't use it.
All right, Andrew, thank you. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, Russian authorities are now barring American diplomats and their families from a U.S. recreational residence on the outskirts of Moscow, part of sweeping retaliatory measures announced by Kremlin leader Vladimir Putin. Deputy Foreign Minister of the Russian Federation, Sergei Rybkov, on Moscow's opinion and position.
It was the last drop. If the U.S. side decides to move further towards further deterioration, we will answer, we will respond in kind. We will mirror this. We will retaliate. But my call and my whole point is, don't do this. It's to the detriment of the interests of the U.S.
The Russian president ordered the U.S. on Sunday to cut its overall staff of more than 1,200 in Russia by 755 in response to the new U.S. sanctions imposed for its interference in the 2016 presidential election. It's believed to be the single largest cut ever imposed on the U.S. embassy in Moscow and consulates elsewhere in Russia, although many of those to be dismissed are likely Russians working in support positions. University of Denver Russia scholar Jonathan Adelman on why the situation could actually benefit the president.
For Donald Trump, this is great. He's being accused of colluding with the Russians, doing all sorts of things. And by going along with this, he answers his detractors, who are very numerous at this time, and says, well, if I were so, why would I be punishing them? If you look at public opinion polling data, Russia is not the main interest of the American public. It is about the economy. It's about jobs. It's about the future. And this is low down on the list, and it's going to push it lower.
President Trump has been silent on the issue since Putin announced his retaliatory action. Well, the president uttered assurances during the start of his cabinet meeting Monday morning that the threat from North Korea will be taken care of.
We'll handle North Korea. We're going to be able to handle it. It will be handled. We handle everything.
On Saturday, a day after North Korea tested a ballistic missile it claims can reach all of the United States, the president took to social media with blunt criticism of China, North Korea's powerful neighbor and single significant ally. Vice President Mike Pence, speaking from Estonia Sunday, where he met with the presidents of all the Baltic states, talked about the situation and the need for China's cooperation.
The president has been clear about that in his conversations with President Xi, that while China has taken unprecedented steps to begin to isolate North Korea economically and to bring diplomatic pressure, we believe China has a unique relationship with the regime in North Korea and has a unique ability to influence decisions by that regime. And we call on China to use that influence along with other nations in the region to encourage North Korea to join the family of nations, to embrace a nuclear-free Korean peninsula and abandon its provocative actions and its ballistic missile program.
Well, for more on these growing concerns and what it takes to resolve this crisis is former U.S. Ambassador and CEO of the East-West Institute, Cameron Munter. Thank you so much for being with us. So from your perspective, what can be done here?
The question in diplomacy is, what's the right way to defuse this? Is there a way that you can work with allies there or other countries? You remember the famous six-party talks that used to take place, Russia, China, North Korea, South Korea, Japan, and the United States. Would a multilateral set of talks help restrain the possibility of conflict? Would bilateral talks help? And there are a number of quiet back channels that take place that involve America and North Korea. The East-West Institute engages with its colleagues in China to try to figure out from them what they think the best methods might be to try to restrain North Korea. So again, we're not judging whether a warhead could hit the United States. We assume yes, no, but based on what we read. The real question is, what is it at the core of what's going on in North Korea that we can address to try to take away that threat?
We've heard a lot about China and how important China's role really is in resolving some of these issues. The president has taken to Twitter to sort of, I wouldn't say shame China, but sort of expresses displeasure at them not doing more. I'd like to know your views on just that form of communication with a situation as serious as this.
As a former diplomat, I'm not one to think that there is a time for public diplomacy, and there's a time for quiet diplomacy. In my mind, especially with China and with North Korea, this is not a time for public diplomacy. So I think that it doesn't help if you are seeking the help of China. If you believe that working with China is one means by which the problem in North Korea can be solved, mm-hmm. the public shaming, in my opinion, is not likely to be very effective. Secondly, there's the broader question of trying to figure out the timeline of what you're going to do. Is this something that really must be solved right away? If it is, you're going to take certain steps. Is this something that is a longer-term question? As you know, the Chinese and the diplomacy of China tends in the direction of trying to look long-term at issues. So sometimes, if you want to inspire the Chinese to do the right thing, taking a longer-term view yourself might help.
Do you think that China is actually willing to diffuse the situation? Because it really, for all these years, doesn't seem like any administration has ever been able to get them to really fix the situation. It hasn't worked up to now.
What I would suggest is we look very hard at what we think Chinese motivations are. We know what the American motivation is, and President Trump has made this quite clear. The Chinese should basically shut down its economic support of North Korea. And that's what the Americans would like the Chinese to do. The Chinese don't do that. So we have a choice. We can get angry and be disappointed with them, or we can ask ourselves, why aren't the Chinese doing that? If we believe, and it's anyone's guess, if we believe, as the Chinese tell us, that they are also concerned about the nuclear program, the ballistic missile program, and the political behavior of the North Korean leadership, the Chinese say they're concerned about that and worried. If they're worried, why is it that they don't do as we say? Right? An elemental kind of behavioral psychology would suggest that we speak with the Chinese and say, what is it that you think is the right way to do this? We don't have to agree with it, but try to figure it out. What we've done up till now, it seems, is to say, we want them to shut off the spigots to North Korea. They're not doing it, therefore this is unacceptable. That does not seem as sophisticated to me as we need to be. Case, I'm convinced that there may be common ground in which the American and the Chinese approach to North Korea may not be exactly what either side wants, but it may be enough for them to work together. Doing this kind of Twitter diplomacy, to me, makes it a little tough. The East-West Institute would like to contribute to this. We'd like to contribute to what, in every way, we can bring American and Chinese and eventually even North Koreans to the table. If we can do it, we will. Korea.
Do you see a solution to this?
If there's going to be a solution, it is probably not going to be 100% what everyone wants. China says it wants security on its border and stability on its border and fears that any military action would be antithetical to that. America is not next door to these countries. And if there were to be hostilities, America would be, even though we have tens of thousands of troops there, America would not be affected as the other ones are in the region. So what's the solution? This is like three-dimensional chess. There's a lot of things that have to be taken into account, and everyone would have to sit down and try to figure out what the other people want and find out, is there a least common denominator that everyone can agree on? We haven't figured out how to do that yet. I'm hoping we will.
U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Nikki Haley was asked about the situation just this week and said something to the likes of, we're done talking regarding North Korea. That did raise some eyebrows. What's your take on that?
Maybe I'm one of those people who has too optimistic a view of life, but maybe that's why I was a diplomat. You never stop talking. Never. There's never a point when you stop talking. Even when there's hostilities, you don't stop talking. The point is that if you are not happy with the way things are turning out and the trajectory of events doesn't seem to be leading where you're going, you have to be able, even if it's tough talk, you have to be able to talk. I just think that people need to talk, even if they're frustrated and skeptical and not sure that the other side will do anything. You have to talk.
That's former U.S. Ambassador and CEO of the East-West Institute, Cameron Munter. We thank you for your perspective. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
This is VOA's International Edition. In the U.S. state of Illinois, the Department of Natural Resources is reintroducing a living fossil into its waterways. The alligator gar is a fish so old it's thought to have evolved during the early Cretaceous period over 100 million years ago. Erica Celeste reports from Kaskaskia River State Fish and Wildlife Area.
Alligator gar are the second largest freshwater fish in North America. They disappeared from Illinois' waterways in the 1990s.
We wanted to restore that part of the ecosystem because it is important to have top predators to balance the species below them in order to keep check on some more abundant species.
Fisheries biologist Randy Sauer says beyond that, alligator gar make for some great big game fishing. The diamond-scaled animals, which can breathe both air and water, can grow up to 2.7 meters and weigh more than 136 kilograms. In fact, their large size is what did them in originally in the state.
It was pretty much extirpated from a lot of its range because of misconceptions about it eating sport fish, and people would target it and literally put bounties on the capture of these fish.
The alligator gar is an opportunistic eater, meaning it will eat whatever it encounters, from an occasional turtle or small duck to invasive species such as Asian and silver carp. Sauer hopes the reintroduction program will help the state's efforts to control the carp. Because gar can live up to 60 years, this program is going to take many years to fully expand.
The alligator gar doesn't sexually mature the females till 11 years, and the males not till 6 or 7 years. So at the outset of this project, we're probably going to stock more heavily than we will 10 to 20 years down the road, when hopefully these fish will kind of find each other and start doing the job on their own.
To date, 7,000 alligator gar have been fitted with transponder tags so they can be tracked and then released into the Illinois waterways. As it rains and floods, biologists expect some of the fish to follow the rivers all the way down to Louisiana and Texas. For VOA News, I'm Erica Celeste in the Kaskaskia River State Fish and Wildlife Area.
Well, turning now to a new spy thriller out in theaters. It's a star-packed hit called Atomic Blonde.
I chose this life. And someday, it's going to get me killed. But not today.
Oh, well, join me now for more on this exciting new film is Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Hey, Jeff, so tell us about it.
Well, this was a big hit at the South by Southwest Film Festival, and it's based on the graphic novel The Coldest City. And it's about the final days of the Cold War, and it's set in Berlin. And the Berlin Wall is falling, so it's a spy film. And Charlize Theron plays an English MI6 agent that's out to get this list of agents that are up for sale. So there's this secret list out there of all these agents, and she's got to find it before the Russians do. And it's a very popular graphic novel. And you know, she's been working on like 5 years developing this movie. And since Mad Max Fury Road did really well, this gave her a green light to make this film. And she does essentially all her own stunts in the movie, too. It's like a James Bond, Jason Bourne kind of style movie where, you know, it's slick. It's got great action sequences. She had 8 personal trainers. So when you watch her do these action sequences, when she's punching, when she's leaping, that's really her doing all her own stunts. She even worked with Keanu Reeves, the same people who did John Wick, those kind of stunts. And David Leitch, who's the director of the film, also did John Wick. So it's got that same familiarity to it. And what's really cool is that it's set in the final days of the Cold War, so everything's set in Berlin. So it's got a great 80s soundtrack, 23 great songs by Echo and the Bunnymen, New Order, Depeche Mode, Till Tuesday. And her counterpart in Berlin is James McAvoy, who's her Berlin contact. So he's got this great role that you haven't seen him before. John Goodman plays the CIA contact. And one of the stars of the movie is also Berlin. So they use all these great locations, some great famous landmarks. This is a stylistic movie. It's got great action that you've just never seen someone like her do before. And it's a big hit. It's just a really big hit. And I feel there's going to be a franchise coming along.
It's interesting because we really haven't heard much about this movie. Is it just sort of one that's sort of slipped by?
Well, no, there's been a lot of buzz about it, you know, especially at the film festival a few months ago. They previewed it there, and the audience response was one of the greatest responses they've ever had for a film at the festival. So she was kind of worried. She's done a lot of interviews where she didn't know if this was going to work or not, because, you know, the audience is going to be fickle about settings and about, you know, stylistic. But if you like John Wick, if you like that kind of action, you know, she's drinking vodka every other scene. It's a hard-boiled kind of film. Mm-hmm. And if you know what the French call a femme fatale, like in film noir, that's definitely what she is. She's beautiful, but she's smart and she's dangerous. You know, so she conveys that completely. And she's from South Africa, so when she does that English accent, it's real. You know, she hides it, you know, when she does her American roles, but she really lets this character shine. So I think you're going to see a franchise with this, and it's going to do really, really well.
And so you think there's going to be a TV series on this one?
It could be. There's going to be probably more films. But yeah, you could definitely turn this into a TV show. Hopefully they do it on like an FX or an HBO, because the movie's for adults. You know, it's hardcore, meaning that the violence is graphic, you know, the dialogue and the language and all that. But you know what? It's really cool for me, for someone, you know, who grew up during the Cold War. That was always the villains, right? We always saw it in every James Bond film and all of that. So it's good to see, you know, something at the end of the Cold War when the Berlin Wall fell like that and set in Berlin. So it's got that real classic kind of Cold War vibe-ness to it that I kind of miss. I'd rather have something that, you know, ripped from the history pages than what's current events. You know, the news is bad enough, right? We need some escapism.
No doubt about it, Jeffrey K. Howard. You can find his full video review at VegasFilmCritic.com. That does it for today's show. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Homemade bombs, known as improvised explosive devices, or IEDs, are used by terrorists not only to attack opposition military forces, but also, increasingly, to harm civilian populations. As a world leader in clearing explosive hazards that threaten civilians, the United States is taking action to tackle these deadly devices in Iraq, Syria, Colombia, Afghanistan, and elsewhere around the world. According to the Landmine Monitor, an annual report by a non-governmental organization, person-activated IEDs and improvised landmines caused 1,075 casualties in 2014 and 1,331 casualties in 2015. IEDs are a particular threat to both military personnel and civilians as they enter areas previously occupied by terrorists. For example, during the final months of the battle for Mosul, ISIS sowed the city streets with IEDs to prevent civilians from leaving. Later, as they retreated from the city, the terrorists set thousands of IEDs around critical infrastructure like power and water utilities, schools, and hospitals. Non-state armed groups such as ISIS and the Taliban often use IEDs to destabilize peace operations and terrorize civilian populations in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria, writes Stephanie Pico, a public diplomacy officer at the U.S. Department of State. ISIS also has deliberately placed IEDs before retreating from an area with the intent of prolonging insecurity, inflicting additional casualties on communities struggling to recover, and delaying economic redevelopment in liberated communities long after direct ISIS-instigated hostilities in those areas cease. The United States is the world leader in conventional weapons destruction, including humanitarian demining, having invested over $2.8 billion in projects in more than 100 countries since 1993. In addition to humanitarian demining, the United States counter-IED efforts work to disrupt networks that use IEDs and train the forces fighting those networks to identify IEDs and protect against them. Counter-IED differs from humanitarian demining in that it focuses on deterring, detecting, and preventing IED employment before threats become imminent, writes Stephanie Pico. Working with our allies in the international community, she writes, the United States will continue to develop strategies to address the IED threat to prevent IED users from carrying out their nefarious plans and achieve peace and security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.